Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of April. Anna Quinlan has a new novel, and everybody I know who has a copy of this in his or her hands sits down and reads the whole book because she has that wonderful ability to just keep you turning page after page after page. And I'm wondering actually how she does that. So we'll ask her that. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and she has done so much. She has written a number of nonfiction and fiction books, and I think I've read almost all of her writings. Actually, she's the author of "Rise and Shine," "One True Thing," "Blessings," "Black and Blue," and "Object Lessons." Also, 7 nonfiction books, A Short Guide to a Happy Life, Good Dog, Stay, Being Perfect, Loud and Clear, Living Out Loud, Thinking Out Loud, and How Reading Changed My Life. Her column, Public and Private, won the Pulitzer Prize in 92. And until recently, and I miss this column, we'll talk about this later in the show, why she decided to make way for a new generation. You know, baby boomers are kind of clogging up the works here, holding on to jobs for perhaps, well, for some reason they need to work longer, but holding on to jobs that younger people should be moving into. And so she decided to stop the column. She wrote the Last Word column for Newsweek. I will try and persuade her to return to that during this hour, probably to no avail. Did I tell you the name of her new book? It is Every Last One, and I like this review from the Seattle Times. Her writing is like knitting, prose that wraps the reader in the warmth and familiarity of domestic life. The platters in the sideboard, the naps on the couch, the way a teenager can be warm and affectionate, and then cool and crackling as the day goes on. Then, as in her novels Black and Blue and One True Thing, Quinlan starts to pull at the world that she has knitted and lets it unravel across the pages. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Anna Quinlan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. She is actually going to be in the Milwaukee area this Friday talking about her latest book and signing books and talking about even news events. I'll bet she would do that. She just gets to talk to her husband about them now, and her voice should be heard by a wider audience, I'd say. Email is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Anna Quinlan.
Oh, it's so good to be back with you, Kathleen.
Yeah,
this
it's
the high point of book tour for
oh,
me.
Oh, Anna, thank you so much. And I love having you on the air. I feel like I know you somehow. I told you once before, you remind me of a very dear friend. You look like her. The two of you should meet at some point. And so I feel like I'm talking to somebody I've known a long time. Well, what is it about you? So many people I know who just got the book because it's just out can't stop reading you. You sit down and you're watching even your favorite television program, which I was doing the other night, the finale of a show, and I had your book in my hand, and you just can't stop. You can't. How do you do that? How do you keep the page going for the reader all the time?
Oh, you know, I'm probably the last person who could tell you that in an interesting way, but I do think that one of the things that I find when I try to pick out a section to read at bookstore readings, and by the way, help me with a pronunciation here. On Friday night, I'm going to be in
Mequon.
Is that how you say it? See, I was going to say Mequon and make myself sound like a fool.
I'm glad
in
you
Mequon,
asked.
Next Chapter Bookshop. And my kids had this toy when they were little that was monkeys. And each monkey hooked onto the monkey behind him so that you could make this vast chain of monkeys. And sometimes when I'm writing, I feel like each chapter hooks into the next one, and it makes it difficult for me to find a section to read at bookshops
right.
Because I'm not entirely sure that unhooked from the rest of it, it makes maximum sense. And maybe that carries the reader along a little bit.
Right. Well, it's also the way you write, too. You're just a lovely writer. I wonder how it is, and maybe my mom just sent me too many newspaper clippings about be careful about this, this could happen to you, and it made me a real worrywart for years and years. But I'm wondering how you can let your mind go, because I know how close you are to your children and to your family, to the, and we won't tell people what happens here, but to the worst that could possibly happen. How do you go to that dark side?
Well, I think luckily for me, one of the ways that I'm able to do it as a novelist is that I haven't had to do it as a human being. Mm. I mean, certainly, you know, I've had losses and setbacks in my own life, but I've been living a pretty charmed life, especially with these three kids who are no longer kids but are adults, for, you know, 26 years now. And I think I'm not entirely sure that I would be able to go to any kind of dark place in an imaginary way if it had been my own life. I mean, people ask me the same question about Black and Blue,
right,
which has an element in it of domestic violence. You know, never happened to me, never been touched by it. It took my imagination there, perhaps in part because I didn't have to take myself there.
Hmm. And you're able to write about it in such a gripping way because you're essentially, you know, at heart somewhat of a news gal, because you know the grit in society, and so you understand all of that?
Actually, I think it has a lot more to do with understanding people in a way that may perhaps arise from my years as a reporter. I feel like so much of what I am grew out of that, but also just has to do with a natural a conviviality at some level. And I do think that you know, one of the things here is that the characters are quite alive. At least they were to me when I was writing it.
Oh yes,
and so. You know, the things that happen to them feel as though they're happening to people you really know and really like.
Right. And you take on so many issues, too. The woman in the lead character does gardening, landscaping stuff, and so you're dealing with migrant issues and pay issues and issues that young people seem to be going, anorexia and absolutely bizarre behavior and psychotherapy and all of that. You're dealing with a lot of issues that are with us at this time.
Yeah, I just don't ever think of those things as issues, because having been a reporter, to me, issues are things that happen to enough ordinary people for us to start to notice them. I just sort of think of this as an average family in a lot of ways, who have a lot of the setbacks and a lot of the secrets that a lot of average families have. I mean, you know, you could say, well, you know, alcoholism is an issue, or you can say it's a huge part of the human condition. So I sort of feel myself just living with the Latham family and watching them experience some of the things that so many families are experiencing.
Right. Let's talk about this, and I ask this partially because I have a son who's 17 now, and I think I'm too involved in figuring out what his inner life is, and it seems I can't get a hold on it. But this whole issue of inner lives and our children's inner lives. Glenn thinks, you write, I'm over-involved with our children's inner lives, especially during Ruby's, who stopped eating during freshman year. He complained that his parents never worried, and he was right, neither do mine. What about those inner lives? Is there some message in the book that maybe she didn't get involved enough in the inner lives of her children's friends and her children? Or are we, what about you as a mom with that? How much can we learn about our children's lives, and do we need to learn about them? And at what point is it we're getting too involved?
Well, there's a couple of different aspects of all this. The first is that especially with teenagers, and all three of the children in this family are in their teens, there's so many moving parts. So that when you think you've got a handle on one, you wake up a week later and it's completely changed. And trying to keep your eye on all of these moving parts can mean that you make yourself crazy and that you miss stuff. But the other thing, and I found this very vividly as a mother, is that especially as they move past 14, 15, and they start to get to the age where you're envisioning them going to college and living without you, that you're always having to calibrate keeping them safe with giving them independence. you're always trying to, you know, keep the string taut, but let out a little length on it. And I'm not sure anybody ever feels that they're hitting that exactly right until it's over, until you have a smart, strong, independent 20-something, and you think, wow, I made that work. But as it's happening, you know, you hear endless variations of, or at least you do from your daughters, your sons tend to not report to you about their inner lives in real time. I tend to hear about them about 2 or 3 years after the inner life turmoil is taking place. But certainly with my daughter, it was always, I don't understand why I can't go to school on my own. You know, Amanda and Samantha and, you know, all go to school on their own. Everybody gets to do this. Or conversely, you get the call from the mother who says, is it true that you're letting Maria do? And
yes,
that's your heart sinks. Oh, no, I knew I was a bad mother. So I do think that we try at some level to micromanage this in a way the past generations did not. And some of that is really for the good in terms of our connections to our kids. Some of it is fraught with inevitable failure because they will only let us see so much of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it can tend to infantilize them.
Mm-hmm. How true. Yeah. I remember you just brought back a memory of my mom who passed away some years ago, but I had a reunion, I think, of some of my first year of college of some of my friends who were best friends. And my mom wanted to be front and center, and I really didn't want her to be there. And she didn't understand that. And she was crying in the other room that I didn't involve her, and it was obvious that I wanted to be just with my friends. And that's a memory that has stayed with me as I'm with my family now, that there's a tendency, as we do what our moms did, to become too involved, but also to remember, wait a second, you've got a place, and,
right.
And there's a time, certainly not to be there. I want to talk just a moment before we go back to the book about your contribution to the wider world. I was so, so upset, Anna, when you stopped writing the Newsweek column. And I love the column because I struggle with exactly the question that you were dealing with. There are younger people, you were judging competitions, there was extraordinary writing. But we interviewed Jim Lehrer for part of last hour, and I brought this up talking about you, actually, what decision you had made, and told him I'm glad he stayed around because he's got all this wisdom. I really think that you need to do that again. If it's not Newsweek, then just somewhere, because you are a young woman still, and you've got all these years of experience, and there are new people who can come into the profession, but you've got this really keen observation of what's going on in the world, too, and I kind of tell you I miss it.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that. And, you know, I didn't say, I mean, since I've been gone, I've already done 3 major pieces for Newsweek, 2 of which have appeared on the cover. So I'm not taking myself out of the game entirely, but there's something about doing a regular column.
Mm-hmm.
That really always threatens you with the possibility of staleness and predictability. I don't think that happened to me at Newsweek or at the Times, but I always like to leave before it does. And I really did mean what I said in that last column. I know that lots of us who are baby boomers are still working because we love it, and lots of us are still working because we need the money.
Right.
But I was in a position to be able to leave that column, and one of the reasons I wanted to do it was because I became an op-ed page columnist at the New York Times when I was 36 years old. And I want to read the new, smart, younger, hipper Anna Quinlan. I don't know who she is. I don't know anything about her, but I do know that she's probably foiled in moving from the internet or from a small paper up into a more visible position of punditry, because the pundit class right now tends to be almost entirely people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who haven't moved in a long time.
I am.
And I do think that these great kids in their 20s who are moving up or not moving up have a point when they say, you know, there used to be these kind of neural pathways in the body politic that aren't there anymore because the baby boomer demographic bump is so huge. And while when you and I were kids, people retired at 65. Right. Almost everybody retired at 65. In fact, the year I was born, the life expectancy of Americans was 65. Now that's not the case, and it makes it very difficult for new young voices to be heard.
Right. But then you think of Jim Lehrer, Anna, and he was there when Kennedy was assassinated, and he's what, in his 70s or something now?
I mean, it is such a balancing act between knowledge and wisdom and experience and that kind of zeal and innovation that sometimes younger people bring. And I think I'm probably more hypersensitive to it than most people because, you know, I went to the Times when I was 25. I started working in newspapers when I was 19. I was kind of a wunderkind. I'm not kind anymore.
I know.
So I always have a soft spot for young people coming into the business. And I think that has a lot to do with some of my attitudes.
Well, also you have three children in their 20s, right?
Right.
That has something to do with it.
Yeah, and I hear a certain amount of carping about the lack of pathways.
How are they doing?
Oh, they're fantastic.
Aww.
They're just, oh my gosh, they're just the most interesting people I know. They're just so smart and funny and just a joy, and I think probably more than anything else, I am thrilled at the fact that the three of them are so close to one another. I mean, you know, because my mother died when I was a teenager, I worried through a lot of their childhood about making sure that I was, you know, there for them every step of the way. And now I look at them and think, well, you know, if nothing else, they're totally there for each other.
Oh, isn't that good?
It's fantastic.
Isn't that good? And it is true, no matter, you can be a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, you know, the landscape gardener that the woman is in the book, but being a mom, this thing about being a mom, what a huge thing it is.
It's just so fantastic. I have to say, it completely changed my life, and it made me a better novelist. I mean, I never could have written this novel without those kids.
No, I would imagine you couldn't.
Not because it's autobiographical, not because I bear much resemblance to Mary Beth or her kids to mine, but because they've made me re-experience so much of the world by seeing them experience it and made me understand human behavior and interaction in a way I just wouldn't have had I not gotten a second chance to see it through their eyes.
Right. Well, you also are a keen observer of human behavior, so you see that in your children and in the world.
But yeah, but our whole house was like a Petri dish for years, you know? I mean, anything I needed to know about rivalry, jealousy, growth, maturity,
right.
Love,
right.
Pain, it was all here.
Yeah. So everybody says the 20s are easier than 17, huh?
Oh, it's much.
All right.
They're just more settled. I mean, they just have a clearer sense that, you know, there's that thing when they're 17 where anything that happens, happens in real time and has equal weight. It's as though they can't see beyond the next hour or the next day. They grow out of that in their 20s. They can take a longer view.
To phone calls for Anna Quinlan in just a moment. She has a great new book, Every Last One. It's a novel. She's written many, many novels, and she's a prolific writer. She's done fiction and nonfiction for almost 9 years. She wrote the Last Word column for Newsweek. If you haven't had a chance to read her last column, why don't you Google it and find it, because it's well worth reading. She also did the public and private column for the New York Times, and she won a Pulitzer for that in 1992. All right, to your phone calls and emails in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Anna Quinlan is our guest. The book is her latest, Every Last One, and she's going to be actually in Mequon at the Next Chapter Bookshop this coming Friday at 7 p.m. for a reading and also for a book signing. So mark that. That's on Port Washington Road this Friday at 7 o'clock. Let's go to phone calls now. We start with Erin from Milwaukee. Hi, Erin.
Hi, it's really good to talk to you. I am calling about the, and I couldn't remember the magazine, but now I know that it's Newsweek. The article that you wrote, Mrs. Klingman, about funding for schools and how teachers aren't, you know, paid enough, and what are some things that we can do, like corporations maybe paying more taxes to help out with that. And I do believe that I agree with Kathleen that your ideas should be shared. You should continue to write those articles because it's something that's really important. I'm a teacher, and so thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I actually have a sister who's a teacher, too, and she certainly works a lot harder than I do, and she works harder than almost anyone I know. I always say when I'm doing questions and answers at signings or speeches, I am a writer because of teachers. I am a writer because over and over again, when I was a child, teachers said, you're good at this, here's an A, here's a gold star, keep on doing it. And I honestly don't believe I'd be doing what I do today were it not for the encouragement of teachers.
Hmm. They're so important, aren't they? So
absolutely
important.
Absolutely. And look at how we pay them. It's really disgraceful. Mm-hmm. Teachers and nurses.
Nurses as well. I agree.
Those are my hobby horses.
Right. Nurses. Just think, all you have to do is spend a little time in a hospital. My gosh, your whole life depends on them. Their knowledge and their caring and continuity and their intelligence. Oh, yeah.
People work so hard to find the right doctor. But the truth is, if you're actually going to go into the hospital, it's much more important that you find the hospital with the right nurses.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. Thank you, Erin, very much for your call. Reed is next from Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Yes, good morning. Recently on our talk station here on Wisconsin Public Radio, there was a program dealing with books that we either have not or could not complete for one reason or another. It was a very, very interesting hour. I must apologize by saying that I have tried to get through one of Anna's books, One True Thing. I've gotten to page 53, and after reading the first paragraph or two of the very first page, which was pretty powerful and overwhelming, then I plowed on, and I've tried several times, and I want to apologize for that, but I was wondering, and no sexism intended, but is this book written primarily for women more than for men?
That's an interesting question, and here's how I'll respond to it. First of all, I don't think of audience when I'm writing a novel. Basically, the audience I write for is myself. It would be too confusing to try to picture the various faces of the various people who might pick up your books. But what we do know is that women buy about 85% of the hardcover fiction in the United States. When women read, according to all the data we have, they tend overwhelmingly to read fiction or sometimes self-help. When men read, they tend overwhelmingly to read history and biography. Don't ask me why. A male professor was saying to me the other day when I was saying, I read a book to understand myself. He said, that's so interesting, Anna, because I read a book to understand the outside world.
Oh, it is.
And
interesting.
I do frequently wonder in the ways in which, for example, male and female friendships seem to me quite different. Sometimes male and female parenting seems to me different. I do sometimes wonder whether male and female reading is different in some essential ways. Mm. But it's also entirely possible that, you know, I write books that don't happen to speak to you. Mm-hmm. My son, my oldest son, who is a very, very well-read person, and I have had frequent tussles about certain writers that I love. For example, he was quite dismissive of The House of Mirth, which is one of my favorite novels, and I think he's wrong. I don't particularly care for Joseph Conrad's work. I admire it, but don't love it in the way that Quinn does. And he felt bound and determined to make me return to Moby Dick. And on that one, we have found common ground. I reread it and discovered that, in fact, he was right about it, and that I do admire and even love it a great deal more than I did when I first read it some 35 years ago.
I never got through it. So it should be given another chance. Huh?
I think it should. It's a pretty remarkable book. And actually, I did something which really enhanced my enjoyment of it and of the book I was reading alongside it. About 3 months ago, there was released a nonfiction book called The Whale, about whales. And I read it alongside Moby Dick. And I must say, it was a terrific pairing.
Oh, it was.
What
an inventive idea that was, Anna. Thank you so much, Reed, for your call. Dot is next from Madison. Hi, Dot.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I was so excited to hear Anna Quinlan that I can't even set my mind straight about a question, because I just wanted to tell you that you have enriched my life and my leisure in ways nobody in the entire world has. I think you're the best author ever graced the earth, and I just appreciate so much your writing. I'm trying to think still of a good question. I work with children, and I wonder if you might be able to say some of your favorite, or one at least, of your favorite children novels.
Hmm. Oh, gosh. I have so many children's books that I love so much, but one of a series of books that actually I think contributed to making me a writer is a series of books that were written early in the 20th century by a woman named Maud Hart Lovelace. And they're about two little girls growing up in what's called Deep Valley, Minnesota, but I've learned is actually Mankato, Minnesota, called Betsy and Tacy. And the series of books are called the Betsy, Tacy, and Tibbs stories. They start when Betsy and Tacy are in kindergarten, and they end when Betsy gets married after she's graduated from college. And they're absolutely wonderful. And the great thing is that, you know, you can start a 6 or 7 year old with the early ones, and then she can just live through Betsy's life straight up until she becomes a young adult. So I just love, love, love those books.
And will you consider coming through Madison and any future book tours? I would so love to see you.
That hasn't happened yet, but I would love to stop into Madison. I've heard so much about it. And if I do, you have to come up and introduce yourself, because nobody said things quite as nice to me as you just said.
I'm just so excited. I just can't wait to tell all my friends and family I spoke to you on the phone. And I'm going to get off and let somebody else enjoy some of the
Thank you so much, Dot.
Thank you. Thank you, Dot. Well, we may as well stop now.
Yeah, really. I want Dot to come to my house and say that to me every morning.
Well, we can send you a tape. I think we should. That was just wonderful. Let's go to an email. Here's another person who thinks you should resume writing your column. This woman feels so bereft without Molly Ivins and Anna Quinlan's and Jacqueline Michard's regular columns. If you can't resume your column, perhaps you could suggest someone who we could read, new and upcoming columnists we might not have been aware of.
Well, I don't know about someone that people aren't aware of. I mean, the columnist whose work I really enjoy now, because she hits it just right between being funny, witty, and really making me think about the issues, is Gail Collins of the New York Times.
She is good, yes.
I think Gail's column is just terrific, and I love reading it. So she's somebody that I never miss. Boy, but Molly Ivins is really missed, isn't she?
Yes.
Talk about speaking truth to power.
I mean,
Molly was never worried or cowardly about any opinion. She just let it rip, and I love that about her.
Yeah, I am. I'm with you on that. Let's go to Ingrid from Wauwatosa. Hi, Ingrid.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, excited to actually be on a phone call with Anna Quinlan. Holy cow. Listen, I wanted to thank you, Anna, for, you know, your books and your columns over the years. Obviously, like everyone else, I was disappointed. But I can't get out of my head what you said about making room for the younger voices. So I was fortunate to have a daughter graduate in journalism, get a job, and actually works for the Chicago Tribune Local.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay. What great news.
Yes.
Exactly. Isn't that encouraging for everyone to hear a graduate with a job?
It
right.
is. It just makes me happy because working in newspapers is, to my mind, the world's best job.
She loves it, although right now what she mentions is how hard it is because it's kind of like she's doing the job of three people because the industry is trying to figure things out, you know. But so they have like a web page as well as traditional print journalism and kind of do PR work. But I hope she becomes one of your voices. And, in fact, this is my segue to thanking you for showing up at Issues because I was one of the moms that led a group to Million Mom March years ago.
Oh, yeah, that was a great opportunity for me. I'll never forget that. I was with my kids, and we were in this backstage holding area, and, boy, you haven't lived until you've stepped out onto a stage at the National Mall in Washington and seen hundreds of thousands of people in front of you. What a rush. And what a great issue.
It really was and like you said, I mean, it was the first thing I took my kids to, my daughters, and really felt like, you know, it empowered our sense of awareness.
I think actually you make a point, too, about newspapers today that isn't adequately appreciated by newspaper readers, and that is young reporters in the business now are working much, much, much harder than I ever worked. They're working much more like the AP guys of my youth used to work. You know, I would cover something, write one story, and unless it was a moving target, I filed it at 6 o'clock and went home for the night, and that was it. It ran that way in all editions. Now you go out to cover a story, you do a short version that goes up right away on the website. You might do some blog post about it. Then you add more for the later editions of the paper. Then you add more for the later editions of the website. The end result is that people in the business now are writing and rewriting the same story, adding and subtracting and tightening and getting more information 6, 7, 8 times a day, which is something I never had to do.
It is different, isn't it?
Well, and that, I'm sure she would amen that, you know, and like I said, she feels like she's doing three jobs, and then, and everyone's trying to figure things out, so there's no one to mentor you, I think, like in the old school way, you know, so, but I just want to also get off, give someone else a chance, and thank you, because I felt like you were that voice that was that hands-on traditional mom, yet your issues and heart were with the liberals.
Well,
so
thanks.
I could identify.
I am a proud liberal.
Yeah,
I know we're supposed
I
to say progressive
that, you know,
now because liberal became a dirty word, but in the same way that people tried to make feminism into a dirty word, you know, I want to reclaim my reality. I'm a proud liberal, and I'm a proud feminist.
Ooh,
and
Anna.
I'm a proud mother.
All right.
You just gave me courage to take that back.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ingrid.
All right, bye-bye.
You should send your daughter to visit us. We'd like to see her. Anna Quinlan is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. She has a new book, and it's highly recommended, Every Last One. A beautifully written novel about Mary Beth Latham and her three teenage children, Max and Alex and Ruby, and her husband, Glenn, who's an, I always say this word wrong, ophthalmologist. And the family is rocked by a horrendous act of violence, so it's just very well written and full of insights, as Anna always is. So, more phone calls in a moment. I gave you the number. A couple lines are open now. They've been busy. 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to some emails, Anna. This is from Karen in Eau Claire. I've been a longtime fan of Anna's work. The first book I read was One True Thing. I read this as a teenager and at my mother's insisting and enjoyed it. Now as a parent myself, I can appreciate how it delves into the often thankless job of motherhood and the often difficult relationship between a mother and a daughter. I was wondering if any part of the book was autobiographical.
Well, I do know what it's like to watch somebody die by inches from cancer, because unfortunately that happened to my mother when I was 19. But I think that's where autobiography ends. I thought my mother was the greatest thing since sliced bread. In some ways, because as is true of Kate Golden and Ellen Golden in One True Thing, we were quite different. She was a person with great patience and an enormous capacity for unconditional love, which I thought at the time was commonplace, and I know now is quite rare. But Ellen is, in many ways, the character that I've built a novel around that I've liked least, and I don't think I'm very much like her. And Kate, in many ways, is quite different from my mother, and her father, George, Kate's husband, is completely, bears no resemblance to my father. It's interesting, though, readers always assume that there's some strong element of autobiography in fictional work, and some of them are quite surprised to discover that, unlike Ellen, my father is not a college professor.
Well, this begs the question, then, if you say the character you like least, I must ask about the characters you like the best.
You know, they tend to be secondary characters. Huh. I'm a huge Dickens fan. I read and reread Dickens constantly. I really feel like he's been the most influential writer in my life. And I think if you've read Bleak House or you've read A Christmas Carol or any of the Oliver Twist, it's the secondary characters that are most vivid, in part because they're a little cartoony in Dickens. And the protagonists are more middle of the road, I guess, in a lot of ways. And in a lot of my books, it is those secondary characters that I really like. In Rise and Shine, there's a guy named Irving Lefkowitz, who I really have a soft spot for. And in this book, actually, there is what originally was a very minor character, a therapist named Dr. Vagelos.
Oh. Yes,
who became a much more significant character as I was working on the book. And I really, really like him. In many ways, I think he's the most likable character in the book.
Yeah, he is a very significant character to the children in many ways.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're tootling along thinking that somebody is going to make a cameo appearance and come and go, and then you realize that you've created someone who should be playing a much bigger role in your narrative than you'd first imagined.
Yes. Isn't that something, what you just said, somebody you've created? There, what you do is so remarkable. You've created them, you put it on a page. It's going to be around for thousands of years.
What novelists do is pretty remarkable. I mean, think of the fact that Jane Austen wrote Pride and Prejudice more than 200 years
ago.
Oh, my. More than 200 years ago. I mean, this little single woman, by the standards of her time, she would have been described as a spinster, living in England, and the book, and she had to pay to have the book published. maybe not Pride and Prejudice; it might have been Sense and Sensibility, which was the first one she actually had published. And it's never been out of print, and people read it today as though she wrote it last year.
Right.
It really is amazing.
It is amazing. Nikki is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Nikki.
Hello. First of all, I want to also say that I'm a huge fan of Anna's work. And why I'm really calling is I was really intrigued by her saying that she's looking for the next Anna Quinlan, because as a mother of a writer who I think is witty and intelligent and has an undergraduate degree in journalism from Northwestern, I think she is the next Anna Quinlan. She also loves your work, but she simply cannot find a job. Yeah. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a tough market out there, and what I always tell young people to do is, I used to say, go to the library and get a copy of Editor and Publisher, which is about as big as the old Sears catalog, which is a reference that just made me seem so ancient that I cannot believe it. But anyhow, now you can go online to Editor and Publisher and look at small to mid-sized dailies in any place in the United States that you can possibly bear to spend a couple of years, and then send out 50 or 60 pitch letters. And on the when each pitch letter either goes into the ether and hasn't been responded to in a month, or goes out into the ether and you get one of those nice, sorry, we're not hiring letters, that very day, send out another one to a different place. I mean, I think it's such a tough market that the scattershot approach where, you know, you send out 100 shots to see if you'll get just one bullseye is the only way to go. But I'm hugely sympathetic.
Yes. Thank you, Nikki, so much for your call. And the business, of course, changed so much since you started in newspapers. Are there enough jobs replacing those newspaper jobs in computers, in the Internet? Is all of that blossoming?
Well, a lot of it's blossoming, but a lot of it doesn't pay or doesn't pay very much. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the question is, can you afford to be a full-time writer for a website that, you know, pays you in, you know, a music website that pays you in CDs and concert tickets?
Right.
That sort of thing. And
right.
And the answer for a lot of young people is, yeah, I can if I still live at home with my parents. Look, we're in a period where we're making all of this up as we go. And some places are doing a pretty good job of trying to figure out how to make online content pay, and some places not so much. And I only pray that sometime in the next 5 years or so, the model begins to solidify and we begin to get a better sense of what the communications profession is going to look like in the future.
Right. Karen from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Anna. It's so great to talk to you. And so much of what you have said on this program rings true for me. I suspect we're from the same generation. But everything about children, about writing, and especially the aspect about things being stale. I was an editor of a trade publication for 5 years, and sure enough, that did get stale. But my question is, I have had a varied life, and so many of my friends and family often say to me, oh, God, you should write a book. And I'm just wondering, it just seems daunting, and I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions or recommendations as to how to even get started on something like that.
Yeah, I do. I can't imagine what it would be like if one fine day I sat down at the computer and thought, I'm going to write a novel now. I mean, you know, okay, gee, I just wrote a sentence, only 85,000 words to go. I mean, that would send me to the outlet so fast it would make your head spin. I don't think of it that way. I think I'll write a couple of pages. And I think that's how you have to approach it. You know, I'm somebody who most of her life has written in 800 or 900 word bites. And that's what I do most work days. I try to churn out 800, 900, 1,000 words and hope that it's good. And if you do that for long enough, at the end you wind up with a book. But I think that you've got to think of it more in terms of bite-sized pieces and individual scenes and themes than in terms of a great big thing.
Thanks so much for your call, Karen. Here's an email that's come in. Ruth from West Dallas. Anna absolutely has to read the Whale Song Trilogy. Amazing, wonderful books. Do you know them?
No, I don't, but I just wrote them down.
Yeah, I'm going to write that down, too.
I love book recommendations.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding?
I love doing book shows. We do shows with Nancy Pearl. Oh, my gosh, does she have a mind for books, Anna. Oh, my gosh.
Well, you know, there's so much good stuff being published out there that your chances of missing something are huge. I mean, I mentioned before the children's books, the Betsy Tacy stories.
Right.
It's really interesting to me that I'll be talking before a huge audience, and I'll mention them, and about 90% of the audience looks really blank, and the other 10% make this sound. Oh, it tells me that they're as big fans as I am, and I think, you know, So here are these great books, and 9 out of 10 people have
don't
never
know.
Heard of them.
Isn't that terrible?
Any opportunity to spread the word about good writers,
right.
I think, should be seized.
I agree. Let's go to Leah from Green Bay. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Hi.
By the way, I'm a Betsy Tacy Tim fan, so
yay.
I want to mention that. But I wanted to talk about the changing face of journalism. I had a chance to read A Long-Range Plan by the Medill Journalism School a few years ago, and the key point seemed to be, well, we're going to hook up with the marketing, integrated marketing graduate school, and that's how we're going to train our students. And it really upset me because, I mean, what we used to call news isn't news anymore. It's acting and screaming and yelling, and I wonder what you think about that.
I think that there's a lot of truth to what you just said, but I also think there's a lot of truth to a counter view, and I'm going to offer it. I think it's possible for your average American to be better informed about what's going on in the world today than at any time in the nation's history. Not because you can rely on one single source. You can't any longer walk out in the morning, pick up a single newspaper, bring it into your kitchen, sit down, and know what's going on. Those days are done. And by the way, those days were never really that great because a lot of local newspapers were incredibly boosterish and never wrote anything bad about their town and never wrote anything bad about their government or the big companies in their town. I'm talking about in the 40s and 50s and 60s. You know, it wasn't until the Watergate era that local newspapers started to turn a more searching eye on local institutions. But using the internet, using newspapers, using public radio, using television news, you can cobble together and be your own aggregator really, really good sources. I mean, for the first time in our history, we have constant access to the BBC, which does extraordinary foreign reporting. Every town in the United States has access to the New York Times. We can pull up the AP wires, and if we don't trust the AP reporter, we can actually pull up the speeches given by the congressman that the AP wire service reporter was covering. So I think if an educated consumer does the work, that you can be extraordinarily well informed. People say to me, well, you know, I don't really, it's a very busy life, I'm working, I have kids, I don't have time to do that. And my ubiquitous answer now is, if Americans have the time to watch Dancing with the Stars, they have the time to pull together news sources for themselves at least a couple times a week.
Well, I think you're optimistic that people are going to be doing that. I think it would be wonderful, but most of the people I know listen to one station or read one paper, and they trash the others because it isn't their point of view.
Well, you know, the problem with that is, for example, as I said earlier, I'm a liberal, and my columns were clearly informed by a liberal sensibility. I spend a lot of time watching Fox News in the evenings, and people say, oh, my God, how can you do that? Because if I'm going to be a liberal, I need to know what conservatives are saying in terms of pushback. So if you're going to suggest that you have an informed political opinion about anything, you have got to have listened to the arguments from both sides and not exist in an echo chamber in which you merely hear your own opinions reflected back to you.
Thanks, Leah, so much for the call. Are you doing a big tour now, Anna?
I am, yeah. I'm going to be in Chicago tomorrow and then Milwaukee on
Friday.
And then next week I think it's Philadelphia and maybe Boston. And then it doesn't get over until about the middle of May. And then I sort of collapse and then my daughter graduates from college.
Oh, she is?
And we party all the time. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank
That's
you.
Great. And is the tour tiring? I would think that a lot of people would love to talk to you and that you might kind of get a kick out of some of it.
You know, it can be really tiring. And the truth is, to the extent that fiction writers don't really know precisely how they do what they do, it can be a challenge. But I spend most of my time by myself in a little room in front of a blank computer screen. And to meet people who are actually reading
right.
what I write is, you live on that for the next couple of years.
Right. Well, you can live on that call you got earlier.
Oh, I know.
More than
God
that.
God bless Dot. She's sticking with me for the rest of the day.
Good. And beyond, I hope. Well, I love reading you and talking to you, and I urge you to return to the public square maybe once a month. I don't care how often, but you've heard that from a lot of you. I'm sure you hear it from a lot of people all over, but we miss you. And the next
time. It's really great to hear. It's really great to hear.
Good.
And I always love being on this show.
Yeah, I love having you on. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Anna Quinlan, her last book is Every Last One. It's her latest novel. It has just been published by Random House, and well worth the read. It's amazing the places she can take us in her writing. She, for a number of years, it's interesting how many people have urged her to return to the public world, wrote the Last Word column for Newsweek. She was a star at the New York Times when she was in her 20s. She wrote the private public column for the New York Times and won a public private, actually, is the way that should go. Won a Pulitzer for commentary in 1992 and has written many, many nonfiction and fiction works. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. And no, Chrissy Peace did production as well here. And Chrissy produced the program and did honor production as well. Thanks, Chrissy. She's a young journalist who has just graduated, and we're glad she's here. I know it's hard to get into the business. It's getting closer to retirement. You do shows like this and you say, oh my, time to move on. Now, I'm not doing that yet, but we'll be with you tomorrow.